Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 10th, 2015. The unprecedented interference in the Iran negotiations by rogue Republicans. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. 47 Republican senators, led by a freshman from Arkansas named Tom Cotton, I think crossed an important line yesterday. And while the White House is pushing back, I think this should be a full stop. I think that these people need to be called out as traitors. Because to undermine these international negotiations, it's not just bilateral between the U.S. and Iran. There are other nations involved, five other nations. And these Republicans are brutally attempting to scuttle these talks. They want war, not peace. And I really think that this is a critical moment where the Obama administration and the Democrats should stage some sort of dramatic protest. I don't really know if a Senate filibuster is possible. There isn't a bill being debated before the Senate about this. But this is such an unprecedented and uncalled for action that I think dramatic response is required. And sure, you know, Joe Biden has been the administration's point man on this. This letter, he says, ignores two centuries of precedent and threatens to undermine the ability of any future American president, whether Democrat or Republican, to negotiate with other nations on behalf of the United States. But words and the way President Obama characterized the Republicans as supporting the hardliners in Iran, it really doesn't have much impact. And I really think the president needs to call these people out. But I'm afraid that Mr. Cool, no drama Obama, will let it slide. And I'm relieved to see that the foreign minister of Iran is quite dismissive of this Republican ploy. In our view, this letter has no legal value. It's a propaganda ploy. It's interesting that while negotiations are still in progress and no agreement has been reached, some political pressure groups are so afraid even of the prospect of an agreement that they resort to unconventional methods unprecedented in diplomatic history. Now, here's the adult in the room. He goes on, this indicates, like Netanyahu, who considers peace as an existential threat, some are opposed to any agreement regardless of its content. Zarif continues, I should bring one important point to the attention of the authors, and that is, the world is not the United States. And the conduct of interstate relations is governed by international law, not U.S. domestic law. The authors may not fully understand that in international law, governments represent the entirety of their respective states. And he added that a change of administration does not in any way relieve the next administration from international obligations undertaken by its predecessor in a possible agreement about Iran's nuclear program. And he says, you know, if, as the letter threatens, the next administration revokes any agreement with, quote, the stroke of a pen, it will simply have committed a blatant violation of international law. So you scratch your head and say, why would Tom Cotton, an Iraq veteran, clearly a very hawkish guy, but as a freshman in the Senate, why would he lead this charge? Who benefits from a war with Iran? Well, today, Tom Cotton, the Republican from Arkansas, is appearing in an off-the-record event with the National Defense Industrial Association. Guess who the members are? Northrop Grumman, L3, Mantech International, Boeing, Oshkosh Defense, and Booz Allen Hamilton, among others. And the New Republic has said, pick a topic, Syria, Iran, Russia, ISIS, drones, NSA snooping. Tom Cotton can be found on the hawkish outer edge of the debate. On Iran, Cotton has issued specific calls for military intervention. In December, he said Congress should consider supplying Israel with B-52s and bunker buster bombs, both manufactured by Boeing. So you can follow the money and see how it fuels the ideology, how Republicans are driving this wedge between Obama and Israel. And these are really dangerous. This is not just rhetoric. It's not just posturing. These are very dangerous moves that they have made. And they put us at risk for a new conflict in the Middle East. And I'm just shaking my head. I can't believe that these people would call themselves Americans and operate in this manner. Well, the unity government between Fatah and Hamas appears to be crumbling in the Palestinian territories. In a series of late-night and dawn raids, the Fatah-dominated Palestinian Authority has arrested 50 supporters of Hamas in the West Bank over the last 2 days, and as many as 100 Hamas and Islamic Jihad supporters have reportedly been arrested in the last 2 weeks. There's a little tit-for-tat here. Last week, about 20 Fatah members in Gaza were arrested by Hamas. When the Palestinians squabble among themselves, it only empowers their oppressor, and I am really sorry to see this happen. The New York Times today gave us some insight in a lengthy article about the man who is challenging Netanyahu for prime minister in Israel in the election that's just 1 week away. His name is Isaac Herzog. He's from the famous Herzog family. His father, Chaim Herzog, was the 6th prime minister of Israel. And he's been a cabinet minister for housing, social welfare, tourism. He's seen as a kind of a nebbish of a guy, and he's trying to work on, his public image a little bit. But I am trying to learn more about his politics, and I have learned very little from American media about the man who is trending to defeat Bibi Netanyahu. And we learn that his nickname is Boogie, so Boogie might beat Bibi. But where does Boogie stand on Iran? Well, he criticizes Netanyahu for emphasizing the Iranian threat too much. But he also has criticized Netanyahu for the prisoner swap with Palestinians and hammered him for his so-called failure to end last year's grisly 50-day war against Hamas with a diplomatic achievement. And so he's calling his coalition the Zionist Union. So Isaac Herzog is not a liberal in the American sense of the term. But the fact that he is not Netanyahu is enough for many people. Same here in the U.S. The Times also ran its first thoughtful piece about Elizabeth Warren's prospects if she runs for president against Hillary Clinton or if Hillary bows out in 2016. And it's written by Nate Cohn, and I think it's a fairly reasonable analysis. He does take a very centrist Democratic perspective and argues that Elizabeth Warren is too liberal to win and that she doesn't have the elements that Barack Obama brought to the game back in 2007-2008. Cohn notes that by this time in the cycle in 2007, Obama had already announced and was polling at about 25%. And, of course, Elizabeth Warren is resisting the entreaties of groups like Move On that she runs. So she's not in the game at all at this point. And I'm one of those people who's an anybody but Hillary supporter. I don't want Hillary, and I want some alternatives. And Elizabeth Warren is excellent on domestic issues, on economic issues. She could expand her base into social justice and attract black voters with a Ferguson-type message. But could she win? And is she schooled enough and strong enough on foreign policy issues? Because that's where Clinton will outpace her, And unfortunately, Elizabeth Warren has taken a Me Too approach to international affairs. She's pro-Israel, and while she didn't go to Netanyahu's speech, she has met with him and embraces the central Zionist cause. So there are many questions about Elizabeth Warren. But as I say, I think it's important that we examine all the potential candidates and not settle in on Hillary, as the past week with the foundation issues at the Clinton Foundation, the foreign dollars that have flowed in there despite pledges that they wouldn't do that, and of course the flap over her private email service. These are things that are causing people to say, well, maybe we should look at Elizabeth Warren or others. New documents from the Ed Snowden cache show us that the CIA has been trying to hack Apple devices for over 10 years. And it's not clear whether the intelligence service has successfully achieved that, but it is thought that they created a version of Xcode, Apple's software application development tool, to create surveillance backdoors into programs distributed on Apple's App Store. And breaching Apple security was part of a top-secret program by the U.S. government and British intelligence researchers to hack secure communication products, both foreign and domestic, including Google's Android phones. And today, the co-founder and current executive director of Wikipedia published an op-ed in the New York Times announcing they filed a lawsuit against the NSA to protect the rights of the 500 million people who use Wikipedia every month. And they have a very reasonable explanation here that we've got a Fourth Amendment right to be protected from search and seizure, and that Wikipedia is edited anonymously by volunteers. And many of those people are not in the United States. And so the op-ed reads, "Whenever someone overseas views or edits a Wikipedia page, it's likely that the NSA is tracking that activity, including the content of what was read or typed, as well as other information that can be linked to the person's physical location and possible identity. These activities are sensitive and private. They can reveal everything from a person's political and religious beliefs to sexual orientation and medical conditions. The notion that NSA is monitoring Wikipedia's users is not, unfortunately, a stretch of the imagination. One of the documents revealed by Ed Snowden specifically identified Wikipedia as a target for surveillance, alongside several other major websites like CNN, Gmail, and Facebook. So I applaud the folks at Wikipedia for raising these issues, and we can only assume that they are correct, that the NSA is monitoring those pages, and that they can do so in ways that violate our rights and, of course, impinge on the rights of non-Americans as well. Every day I like to pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Paul Elsesser, who's right there at the first of every month. Michael Powell just renewed his annual subscription. Faith Peoples has more than one subscription. And Bob Donjacor is a longtime great supporter of my work here. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the link that says sign up. It's right under my picture on the homepage. And from there, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever's comfortable for you and fits your budget. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers earn a bonus gift from me, a copy of Pepe Escobar's ebook called Empire of Chaos. Chelsea Manning penned an op-ed that appeared in Monday's Guardian out of England. Headline, "The CIA's torturers and the leaders who approve their actions must face the law." And Chelsea makes some strong arguments, saying that torture and the mistreatment of detainees in the custody of intelligence personnel is, was, and shall continue to be unethical and morally wrong. Under U.S. law, torture and mistreatment of detainees is also very illegal, she writes, noting that these programs were administered by officers acting under the color of law, and that the programs were authorized at the highest levels of government. Chelsea Manning calls for justice. Regardless of whether these techniques were ineffective and counterproductive, the techniques outlined in the Senate torture report were far outside the boundaries of what is acceptable for the U.S. intelligence community. Their supposed effectiveness is irrelevant to the fact that torture is wrong. That's very eloquent Chelsea Manning, and I agree wholeheartedly. I wish you'd gotten that to Senator Feinstein before she started the process of the torture report and review. And meanwhile, Michael Ratner, who you may know as the President Emeritus of the U.S. Center for Constitutional Rights, is also chairman of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. And they have begun the process of indicting members of the Bush administration by filing criminal complaints in European courts. Now, this is going to be a long process, but I am encouraged that people, principled individuals like Michael Ratner, are looking around the globe for a venue, because we know we're shut out of the U.S. courts. We know that President Obama will not pursue justice for those who have been tortured under our government's custody. And so I hope this proceeds. I think choosing Germany because of the case of Khalid El-Masri, the German national that we picked up and renditioned and tortured, only to find out, whoops, we had the wrong Al-Masri. That case screams for investigation and justice. No justice from the U.S. Supreme Court for Guantanamo inmates. Two appeals were turned back by the High Court on Monday, one barring a Syrian man from suing the U.S. over torture, the other blocking the release of images showing evidence of a Saudi man's mistreatment. And so the courts are complicit in the cover-up and in the constant denial of access to the courts for people who have clearly been brutally wronged by our government. And to see this cover-up continue and to be sustained and embraced by the highest court in our land turns any claims of American exceptionalism as a beacon of liberty, as a home of the rule of law, into utter bullshit. Here's a misguided move by the Obama administration. They've issued an executive order on Monday declaring Venezuela a national security threat. I mean, how stupid can that be? They're sanctioning seven individuals and expressing concern about Venezuelan the government's treatment of political opponents. Now, I would say that the Maduro government is quite mixed, and it has been using draconian methods to crack down on protests. But I don't believe that the U.S. is not involved in trying to overthrow the Maduro government. And I think this is just the latest step in that attempt. And to argue that Venezuela threatens the security of the United States in any way is preposterous. And this has now produced a split with Cuba, because the Raul Castro government there has issued a blistering criticism of the U.S. for this move. And Raul Castro is correct. We've had another unarmed black man, this time a naked man who was acting deranged, shot and killed by police officers. This took place in DeKalb County, just outside Atlanta, on Monday. Anthony Hill, age 27, was shot by a police officer at the Heights apartment complex following the report of a nude man wandering the complex and acting deranged. The caller reported the man had taken off all his clothes and was just running through the entire complex when we received the call. A 7-year veteran of the county police force responded, and when this African-American reportedly ran at the officer who had ordered him to stop, he shot him twice in the upper torso. And once again, deadly force, clearly not necessary here. Not a big fan of tasers, but they didn't even attempt a taser-type takedown of this man. He wasn't armed. He wasn't a threat. And it is this kind of out-of-control policing that needs to be stopped in this country. I've been having a hard time keeping tabs on the Boston Marathon bomber trial because the corporate media in this country isn't interested. They've figured he's already guilty, and the details just don't matter. And while I acknowledge that we're not really going to get the true story out of this trial, it's simply an effort to avoid the death penalty for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, sparks are flying in that courtroom in Boston. Defense attorney Miriam Conrad surgically deconstructed testimony given late on Monday by an FBI agent who had looked at Tsarnaev's Twitter accounts. And the FBI was embarrassed after the defense attorney showed that they had misidentified a picture of a mosque in Chechnya as the Muslim holy site in Mecca. And so what you're about to hear is not critical to the outcome of the case, because the defense has already conceded that he was there and he was involved in the bomb plot. But the shoddy work of the government, the narrative that is riddled with holes in this case, the claims by the government there's a video, and then we learn the video doesn't exist. And so they put a guy on the stand who was not very familiar with the information that he was testifying about. He not only got the picture wrong, but it was part of a long morning of embarrassment for the FBI as the defense poked gaping holes in their investigation into Tsarnaev's online persona. One prosecution witness was forced to admit he didn't know that several of the tweets the prosecution had highlighted were actually lyrics from pop songs, and that one of the quotes came from Comedy Central TV shows. And so we have a situation here where it's a foregone conclusion that the government will win this case, but they can't even get their story straight. And it is pathetic that the corporate media doesn't choose to examine this, to look at the way the government operates, to see the pattern in domestic terrorism prosecutions that make them far more similar to Hollywood screenplays. It's a wacky world we live in, friends. Thanks for listening all the way to the bitter end of my news and comment podcast. I hope you'll share this with somebody. Why don't you do it right now? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.